I'm Jay, and you're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast. I bring you conversations with technologists who've spent time on call. This week, I got a chance to go to the DevOps Enterprise Summit in Las Vegas, Nevada, where I met a million people, it feels like. And I got to have a couple conversations, which I'll be releasing over a couple of weeks. But first, I want to get out this one particular interview just because of... I guess it was just very special for me. I really appreciated it. John Willis, who is newly of Red Hat, prior of places like Chef, Docker, and Bacha Galoop, his own private consulting firm. He's been doing so many things, and if you've read a lot of the most important books out there on DevOps, you probably know who he is. If you don't, I really recommend you you check out his catalog of books, you check out some of his old talks, and on a personal note, John is really, really responsible for me taking a better outlook in the way I handle myself and my career, so I'm really excited to have him on here. If you'd like to be on in the future, it's real easy. Just email me, oncallnightmares, that's with an S, @gmail.com. Once more, oncallnightmares@gmail.com, or reach me on the Twitter account. That is oncallnightmare. So let's get into the conversation with John. I think you're really going to like it. You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and every week, or close to it, I bring you conversations with technologists who've spent time on call. So I've been here at DevOps Enterprise Summit 2019 in Las Vegas, and one of the greatest things that's been part of being at this event is meeting the people that not only are currently doing things in the world of DevOps now, but were foundational to DevOps really becoming something that people all know. And one of them is someone that I think in about 2015, I heard him speak and it changed my career. John Willis is with me. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, man. That's awesome. Now, I remember our conversation. It was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I don't say this to kind of just, you know, kiss your butt about it, but seriously, I know that you've done this for a lot of people, is you've given people ideas and thought processes around the concepts that DevOps should stand for, not that what people think they stand for, but what the concepts that go beyond just creating pipelines. And that's what I love to tell people, that if you think you bought DevOps, then you're probably going to be in a bad situation in a few months when you learned you did it wrong.
Yeah.
So John, you've been part of so many different places. And I don't want to go too far in the past, because I don't want to inundate with everybody how awesome that your career has been for us. And I say that because you've had that experience. But some of the things that I know you've done, you worked out at Chef as VP of delivery or something?
Yeah, service. I mean, we made up my title. I was really the first non-developer. I mean, I can develop, I do develop, but I straddle my career as sort of develop, then do a bunch of meta, mm-hmm. then do develop, do evangelism, do meta, do training. So I do jack of all trades. So I came in there. Everybody else was almost exclusively ex-Amazon. Who mm-hmm. worked on AWS, you know. And so I was brought in as sort of the old guy.
Sure.
That could sort of fill in the gaps of everything. I hired the first sales rep. I created this training mechanism. I started sort of working on, we had no doc. Mm-hmm. Worked on what services might look like. So I was sort of technical, filled in the gaps. But yeah, I was the ninth person in there.
Wow.
And I would say I built Chef's sort of, you know, business technology infrastructure. So yeah.
That's amazing. And then go forward a few more years after that. Eventually, you were working in a director position at Docker, and then move forward. You started doing some stuff on your own, and then now you've got a pretty cool announcement. You want to just tell everybody?
Yeah. So it came out of nowhere. I mean, people in this industry should know Andrew Clay Schaefer. He's a
great guy.
He's one of my heroes. Great, yeah, just intellectual. I've known him for almost 15 years.
The conscientious developer.
Yeah, no, everything about him is brilliant. I mean, I butt heads with him all the time, but in mm-hmm. a way, like a brother fights with his brother.
Sure.
And so he pinged me out of the blue less than a month ago and said, you know, what would you think about coming with me over to Red Hat and IBM? And I'm like, you out of your mind? Mm-hmm. You know, like, did you dial the wrong number? And but then he talked about, this is what I want to do, and I want to bring sort of like really, really people that not only that fit well, but are smart, that think about, to your point, you know, I mean, I think we talked about burnout. Like,
yeah.
It's like DevOps is about like all these sort of seeds. Lean, learning organization, resilience and safety, the stuff Allspar has brought to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a pipeline. It's not just Chef. It's not just Ansible. There's just this, I mean, to get crazy metaphor, but it's a flower of like so many different things. And so what Andrew wants to bring in is these sort of Kevin Baer is part of it. So it's Kevin Baer, Jabe Bloom,
mm-hmm.
Andrew and
Jabe is great.
Jabe is insane.
Jabe, like, if I'm right, is he a PhD?
He's working on a PhD on some insane model for meta transformation in human whatever, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
words I don't even understand.
I think he was at one of the first DevOps days I've ever been to, and it was one of the more enlightening moments.
He's off the chart.
Yeah,
Kevin's off the chart. Kevin's the co-author of the Phoenix project. Mm-hmm. You know, Andrew, and so it's like, John, do you want to work on a team here where we could work together to sort of consolidate? And, you know, I talked to the leadership over there. I was like, I haven't worked for a big company in, like, you know, my whole life.
Yeah.
I try to stay away from big companies. I said,
I know the feeling,
yeah,
John.
And I actually got to talk to Jim Weingarten at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, he's asking me what do we got to do to get you here? And I said, well, you know, hey, Jim, you know, I didn't know that I have the freedom. And the point is, he gave me all the right answers, you know, and he was so down to earth. And
that's
I thought,
great.
You know what? I'm 60 years old. This sounds like a really interesting experiment. You know, Andrew is about like creating chaos experiments. So.
Sure.
And we're starting a team, we're going to build the team, and we'll just see what happens.
It's funny, because I felt similar about going to Microsoft.
Yeah, I bet. I saw when you went to Microsoft, I knew, you know, you...
I've been in startups most of my career. I have been with small places. You know, the biggest place for a while is I was at DataPipe for years, and that eventually got bought out by Rackspace. But, you know, I got to see things on a really big level, but when you go to the big companies, you start recognizing that, one... You don't just get the idea of your work at the big company, but the level of talent that you get exposed to, I think, has been tremendous for me, and I take a lot of honor in somebody being able to say you're good enough to do this with these smart people.
You know, and I'll take my Red Hat hat off, right, which I don't actually wear it today. But you know, I mean, I think, you know, I'll probably get fired at Red Hat at some point because I'll speak my mind.
Sure.
Honestly, what Microsoft has done since Satya has come in, and the type of people, not only like their way they've changed it, but the type of people that you all have hired. Right, like you, Bridget. I mean, we just got on a list of people that are just bringing in these. I joke with the analysts when they call me, like, all my smartest friends are going to Microsoft. I mean, in a small sense, and maybe get bigger, this is what Andrew wants to do at Red Hat.
That's right? Great to hear.
Yeah, so it's the same. I think it's the right model. I mean, as the other companies sort of think about how they're doing things, I really admire the Microsoft model of let's get. You know, technology is great, but like, it's human capital.
Yes,
and you get the right human capital, and it dwarfs by, like you know, any number.
I look
and
at
this
that.
Is Andrew. This is Andrew's dream right now. Andrew's been given sort of a pulpit to say Red Hat. Say, you know, we want you, Andrew, and Andrew's saying, well, if you really want me. This is what we're going to have to do. So this is why I'm excited. I mean, honestly, if we could start doing what you've done at my... You know, I'm going to go on one other round. There's sort of these other companies out there that are sort of like mildly attacking what Andrew's done.
Sure.
Oh, game on. Well, you know what? When I look at Microsoft, I don't see it as game on. I see it as we're both accelerating. What is the motivation? It's the friggin' customer.
Yes, we're all getting better.
So I want you guys to keep... your DevOps is awesome. I want it to keep accelerating. I want us to accelerate. You're never going to hear me say, Jabe, game on. You hired X, we hired Y. But there are other companies out there now that are doing this game on. That's nonsense.
The one thing that I've seen from the announcement, and you can tell me if my interpretation is wrong, it almost seems like you've created an office of the CTO for open source... and that you all can help people come up with better long-term open source solutions from kind of that C-level executive idea, but from real practitioners, yeah. People that have implemented but also have worked alongside in business.
And it's not just the technology stupid, right? And,
yes.
And so, and we've got the freedom to do that, and you know, and then I think that's what that, you know, that's sort of at 6 years old, like, I'm like, that's what gets me jacked up.
Yeah.
It's like, that I can be around, like, to your point, that I'm going to work every, it's funny, me and Andrew were on a call the other day, and we were talking about the logistics of the new company and what are we going to do this, and then we get into a meta conversation about mm-hmm. the future, and we, you know, as we do, we wind up going for like a really long time. It was supposed to be a 50-minute call. It's an hour and a half later.
Sure.
And then Andrew said, you know, by the way, we actually get paid to do this now. You know, and I'm like, yeah. Like, we used to do it on our own free time.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like, all right, this is going to be fun. So
that's awesome. So, to get into a little bit more on the on-call kind of conversation, because
yeah, yeah.
Obviously we're a podcast about on-call, I want to ask you a couple of questions. So one of the things that I've always wanted to ask you, and since you've been in, you know, you're 16, you've been around for a while, what was your first on-call job?
You know, it's funny, my career is, I'd say I've been less on-call,
mm-hmm.
and that's by design.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, but I've, there are points where I've sort of dipped in and out, but I mean, if you go all the way back, the origin of my career, I mean, I started at Exxon running five divisions of, you know, what, mini mainframes,
mm-hmm.
and I was responsible for, you know, sort of all of the geoprocessing, geophysical processing for Exxon in five different cities,
mm-hmm.
which was basically about, you know, 30 mainframes.
Jeez.
And I was the last stop, right? And but the one that I always used to joke about is I got brought into a company called Stratius, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of these things. I'm always the sort of, on the startups, I get a call from somebody and says, I saw you did it, Chef. Can you come do that? Which means I'm sort of the janitor. Like, I fill in everything technical that isn't day-to-day development.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to this company in Stratius, and I inherit a bunch of sort of, you know, sort of on-call. We don't really have a full support thing, but
mm-hmm.
my team is the, you know, they're the ones that are going to go.
Something's broke, they fix it.
We only had like 15 customers. So
sure.
It wasn't, you know, a lot of them were still in different stages. But I was the final stop,
mm-hmm.
On the pager duty call.
Gotcha.
And I remember getting up at one of DevOps days saying, I hate PagerDuty. And the whole PagerDuty guy's like freaking out. Like, what's he going to say? I said, all I know is my wife says, whenever we see this, three, whatever the area code was, number you get at 2 in the morning, I'd get into this massive fight. Like, why is this phone number calling you? Because I was the one that was the last one. So that's probably my funniest on-call story, which was, I was the last stop, and my wife was like, whenever she saw that area code, she'd just get furious at me.
It's funny because one of the on-call things that I recall the most is a few years ago, my wife met Matt Stratton.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe like last year, she met Matt Stratton finally. He came
He's
by.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, one of my I guess one of my best road buddies. I've done things like I got bored and I wanted to go see the Cubs, so I just said, hey, Matt, I'm coming to Chicago.
Cool.
And I just, I flew up for the day.
That's awesome. That's cool.
So, yeah. And
you don't do that with the Yankees, by the way. But, you know.
Well, hey, well, I got to find, next time they hit the Atlanta, I'll see if I can find a spot.
Right.
But one of the great things that came from that is, just funny, my wife turned to Matt, she's like, I really like your company, it's great, but I hate your friggin' product because you woke me up so much.
That was exactly my, she never met anybody from there. She just would always say, what if she saw that number, it meant we were gonna have a fight in the morning.
Yeah. It's amazing. And you know, I had this conversation so many times with people about one of the big things that on-call creates is a form of post-traumatic stress disorder that for people like myself and maybe others who might be listening that aren't on call, like I was on call about 10 years straight.
Wow.
And for about three different companies.
That's a gig, man. That's a tough road.
Yeah, and the thing that I learned from that is that you're not on call on your own, that the people that you love that are a part of your life are also in a way on call also, because, you know, I had Brian Finster here before and he said, you know, I've slept on the couch because I knew that there were going to be alerts.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing when you talk about that, like how on call impacts you more beyond just what your business use case is, but how I've seen on call become something that has helped companies recognize if they don't reduce how much people are called, they're not going to keep those employees.
So, you know, Mark Ibracchio, right?
Mm-hmm. He's a famous. Oh, yeah. Great guy.
He had a startup, right? And, you know, I just made some money after the company I sold to Dell. And I got to dabble in investment. So he showed me the sort of VC pitch that he was going to give to get, was it Operable? Or that was his startup, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he had this, so people know Mark Ibracchio, like, he was 37 Signals. He ran sort of Incident and owned pretty much all the sort of operational infrastructure at GitHub.
And if nowadays you play Fortnite,
yeah,
he's the reason why you're...
If it's
you're
up, it's because of him, right?
Exactly.
But he was at Digital Iron. So he was the sort of, to me, the poster child for how to run great operational infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And so he comes and says, hey, John, I'm doing this startup. Can you look at the startup deck? And I look at it. And their original plan was this full life cycle of incident.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just sort of pager duty, but how do you follow sort of remediation? And,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, oh my God, coming from a guy that knows this space better than anybody on the planet, how do I buy in? So
mm-hmm.
I invested not crazy money. I'll even say it out loud. Is because now my son calls it the $20,000 T-shirt. Because they went under. But the thing, I was so sad because his... One of their goals was if you could do full remediation life cycle, not mm-hmm. just sort of pager duty or Victor Ops, you know, notification. And I know they do more than that. But,
sure.
But he wanted to do what was really the full life cycle of how does it go to remediation, follow the incident, GitHub, come all the way around, the postmortem, the review. And then he was really keen on that if we could get that right,
mm-hmm.
the full life cycle, we could really then start exposing metrics that then, so one of the main goals of that whole thing was to then start figuring out how to use those metrics to improve the lifestyle and the PTSD and all the things that are negative about on-call. So there was a beautiful madness in that method
mm-hmm.
that he wanted to take it to, where ultimately, if you could metric all this, you could get to a world where we could start analyzing the effect of on-call, the hours,
burnout rate,
everything.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, this is like world-changing. I have to invest in this. Unfortunately, startups are like 1 out of 100, and my kid gets to laugh at me when I wear my $20,000 T-shirt.
And at that time, you know, if it's a couple years ago, I would assume that, you know, that's a rough bargain. If you think about between those two specifically, it's kind of amazing, you know. I work with and am friends with Jason Hand, and you know, one of the things that I really respect is how his time at VictorOps wasn't just about this is where you're going to get paged.
Yeah.
Because that's table
Jason's
stakes.
Jason's a meta thinker too.
Yeah.
He's another guy. I don't want to interrupt what you can do, but I know Jason pretty well too, and
yeah.
I've had deep conversations about this subject of
yeah.
it isn't just the sort of exhaustion. It's how it leads to burnout,
mm-hmm. yeah. and how businesses will take long term losses
totally.
By not recognizing patterns. And so one of the things that I've been lucky enough is like recognizing patterns in my own organizations and saying, you know, I went to a place years ago and I asked, why am I getting all these pages? I don't do anything when I get them.
Mm-hmm.
What's the freaking
mm-hmm.
point?
Yeah.
And I really like Jason and I. We really didn't talk that much about, you know, a particular incident that happened on call when he did my podcast. But we talked about how the pain was felt and how I asked him, like, how do you go to organizations that have been doing on call wrong? And when I say wrong, I mean, like, you know, there's not a secondary in the rotation. You don't have enough of a gap built in for when someone has a bad night that they get coverage. You know, like, how do you begin that conversation? And you really say to them, like, how much money are you losing?
You know, Jay Stephen did that too, right? Because, you know, Christina Maslach was here yesterday, speaking,
mm-hmm.
right? And she is the... I accidentally got to meet her through sort of my blogging about burnout, you know, then how we met, really. And we've become good friends. And I invited her to this conference. I'm the one that sort of brought her in.
Sure.
And now she's spoken like 3 or 4 in a row. But Christina Maslach is pretty much the single most authoritative person in occupational burnout.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the canonical test for burnout is called the MBI.
Yeah.
It's called the Maslach Burnout Inventory.
Wow.
Maslach. And just to tell you, so the in this MBI, and I'll drive this right to what you were just talking about here in a minute, that it really spurts on a psychometric survey based on three metrics.
Mm-hmm.
One is exhaustion, which is obvious. And for unfortunately, most of the conversations about burnout, and this is really dangerous, gravitate to exhaustion. Because the other two are the real killers. The other one is cynicism.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
second,
yeah.
And the third one is efficacy. So when you get to, here's the thing that you get to, and I'm not an expert in incident. I've done my time in incident. I'm not like a day-to-day like you and Jason and people who really study it
mm-hmm.
really, really thoroughly now. But what I do know in my time in working around and managing teams that did incident is the two out of those three, exhaustion is easy to catch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's terrible. But like in our industry, and I said this to Christina, I walk around, she was here yesterday in the hallway, and I said, you look around everybody here, we're pretty smart about death marches and stuff. We all make good money. We all can get jobs pretty quick.
Yeah.
We mostly can recognize that
when things come into
we don't want to be in a death march company. So I'm not saying that people don't get burned out from exhaustion. I'm just saying I think our education level, our level of ability to find jobs, we're more likely not to be in a death march versus someplace that's more has better hygiene.
Absolutely, and I think that that has to do with the fact that so many of the skills are being brought up so many levels. Like there are people that are like, you know, they're getting into containers, they're getting into understanding pipelines.
There's so many things that are improving from that perspective. But the deadly killers, the ones where we have suicides in our industry,
sure,
are usually not the exhaustions. They're actually the other two that are the silent killers, the cynicism and in efficacy. And so efficacy for me, a lot of people, you know, I think cynicism is the silent killer in incident, but let me just cover efficacy for a minute. Efficacy is that sort of, you feel that there's a disconnect between your value and what your organization thinks your value. Mm-hmm. And it becomes this vicious cycle of whether it's true or not, you sort of get into the, you know, they don't really appreciate what I do.
And it's beyond imposter syndrome. It becomes a negative.
Oh, and it feeds itself to you. You start driving your own narrative.
Yeah.
Of and I can go on and on. I have about that because I had efficacy problems at doctors.
Sure, same thing.
I mean, I've said in presentations, I ran, there's an MBI, you can run your own MBI for $15. And it'll tell you where you are in the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And when I ran mine when I was working at Docker, I was in fire engine red, and it says the end. It says to you, in the report that you get, it says you should seek professional help. But here's the one about incident.
Mm-hmm.
Incident drives the second deadly killer, the silent killer, that isn't sudden exhaustion, which is you get in this mode where you're just constantly getting bombarded. The hygiene of incident is not set up right in the company, to mm-hmm. your point. And you sort of get cynical. And what I've seen, that cynicism starts with things like people start tagging a certain customer as a dumb customer,
mm-hmm.
right? These inside jokes, stupid customer tricks, and little hashtags that only the team knows. And this becomes sort of...
It's negative culture.
Yeah, and I don't want to... You know, cancer is sort of the wrong word to use in most cases, but...
But it's an infection. I get you.
Thank you. It's an infection, and that's the start of a silent part of burnout, is when you start like getting to the point where you're sort of collaboratively making fun of your customers because, and it's all because the hygiene's not right,
mm-hmm.
you're not having good rotation, somebody's not thinking out this sort of systems approach of it. But anyway, I wanted to turn that into burnout, is that you could literally get that undiagnosed cynicism, which in the MBI is one third of the really the worst of the primary three attributes of what is classified as an industry measure for burnout.
And what's tough about that is that cynicism creates apathy, and you stop caring quite as much about things
exactly.
that are important.
An important point, I'm glad you said that, because most people think they can't decide between cynicism of us just being kind of comical about...
Sure, you can be sarcastic,
but this is a cynicism where you sort of enclave. You know, they're all idiots. You know, so I'm not even going to bother with them because everybody else is an idiot. They don't understand me. And you're right. It's sort of an apathy. It's an enclave. It's one of those nightmarish holes that you get stuck in and you can't get out of.
It's one of those things that I can remember. There was a memory alert that I got years and years ago, and eventually I became so apathetic to it because I felt that it served no purpose. And I would say these customers are dumb. They don't have these, and I didn't realize that it wasn't that the customer was dumb. is that we gave them a bad template. We gave them bad guides to use. And so we paid for our own really poor decisions, and though they were being utilized by the customer.
And your bias started tarnishing too, right?
Yeah, because
now the thing that might have been borderline dumb and might have not been dumb always teetered on dumb because you had this memory, you know, there's the Argus, the seven ladders, the ladders of inference, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Where you literally start, you get into this mode where you hear something, interpret it, and you start creating memory muscle about why you're cognitive bias, and you don't seek alternative answers. And anyway, so
and it's one of the reasons why we do so much on unconscious bias training nowadays, because
we try to break that.
Because those biases end up making decisions for us more than they ever should. And that objectivity that we're supposed to have as technologists, and that's one of the things I think that we should talk more about as an industry, is being objective in what your decision making is when it relates to whether or not you think something is good or bad. Most of the time, good or bad isn't important. It's more about, is the solution going to end up being something that we spend lots and lots of time maintaining and eventually rebuilding all from scratch because we didn't think about it? Or are we making these decisions early on? Are we being conscious about how our time is going to be spent on call? How our time is going to be spent in meetings? And eventually, we feel better as a group communicating. So I want to bring this a little bit closer because I'll be honest, I don't want to take too much of your time today. I enjoy all of it, but a lot of people who are listening, they're probably maybe getting on the off ramp about now, or maybe they're coming up to their subway stop. And I know that I will be, enjoying my trips in Orlando next week when I go to Ignite and have someone carter me around. So I'm going to listen to a lot of these because I'm really excited. One of the things I want to ask you, have you ever managed on-call teams?
I have, yes.
So as a person who's managing an on-call team, what's a piece of advice that you would like to give them right now?
Try to keep it short, but geographic is a problem, right? So there's some sort of horizontal variables that come into play that make it harder than just the simplistic, get the right hygiene, make sure you have, good collaboration on. I mean, it's one thing to set up a sort of a page of duty schedule for on-call rotation. It's another to have an understanding of how the real world comes in.
Sure.
Hey, Jay, I need you to cover me for next Wednesday and Thursday because I got this, right? So being able to not only have the right sort of hygiene process of the on-call, the sanity check, to make sure your management isn't sort of, it's just on call. No, man.
No.
I'm not putting these people 8 hours a day, 7 days a week on call. We will lose them. It won't work. It'll be ugly. So forcing management to understand the value of basically having the proper sort of bandwidth.
And sure.
Which means more headcount, right?
Yes.
Which is always hard, right? But being able to make that argument.
And the right headcount.
Yeah, that's right. The right headcount. But the argument that just having it shrunk to the cleanest ROI in their mind is not the right way to do this. The variables of success are more than just the paycheck of the people.
Absolutely.
Right? And so and that allows you to get the proper hygiene and rotation, the right mix, the right temperament, but then you have to deal with the interruptions of life.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then sort of think about how do you get your team to sort of have, you have stand-ups, you have, you do all the things as a team. Treat your team like any other delivery team, right? You're not just some offshoot. You got a bunch of software delivery teams, and then you got support.
Yeah,
right. No, the support is a level team that is on level. Everybody else, so you operate with your stand ups. You treat them. You sort of have sort of build run notation, so you know the right people. Anyway, it's really just treating it like any other delivery team, and making the same arguments for the balance of resources. And the balance of sort of the right lifestyle to work fit.
Mm-hmm. All that, so. And if I'm on call and I'm burning out right now, what's a piece of advice you got for me, John? Because you gave me some advice personally a couple of years ago. And I want you to, if you've got something for that person on the other side of the podcast, what's a piece of advice?
I think that, I do think the MBI, go take the $15 MBI, right? Because it'll tell you glaring in your face who you are. This is an industry. Psychometrics is a thing. It's a study of how to do statistics and it's how to do statistically valid surveys. So it's the right way. It's not the, hey, you know, do you like this? Yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
It's very well thought out in terms of science. So the MBI is like $15. It's easy to find. Christina has another thing about a work-life balance thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a little more complicated because the MBI is about you versus the organization or you versus the world.
Mm-hmm.
The work-life balance is, it looks at it from the inconsistency of the place you work and you. So it's like doing an MBI against a company's values.
That's interesting.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I've done presentations on it. You can read about her work on it. But here's the thing. It isn't as simple as bad company, good person, good company.
Mm-hmm.
It is some companies have values that may not fit your values.
Sure. So, there's a huge difference between Palantir or working at Chef.
But even more thing, like, so here's the, I always use the, Oscar Rim, I'll say, how many people in this room, and it's usually like a QCon, a place where mostly I know where the answer's going to go. I go, how many people in this room would be upset to know that the top five salesmen make way more than the top five engineers?
Hmm.
And almost everybody raises their hand. Well, I'm saying that doesn't mean it's a bad company. It just means you probably shouldn't work. I've owned five or six big startups.
Mm-hmm.
I want my sales reps to make more money than anybody else in the company.
Mm-hmm.
Because if everybody else has options and stock,
yeah,
we're going to do well.
Hey, the Ballmer era. Right. The Ballmer era was exactly that. Have a high end.
Well, but again, I'm not saying a company where there's, to you, for your sort of belief system, a mm-hmm. company that pays sales reps higher than the top engineers, if that bothers you, and that's going to show up red on your MBI, then don't go work for that company.
And the same thing goes with moral value.
Some companies are very, like ThoughtWorks, very, very liberal. The CEO, very liberal.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to tend that way too. But if you have conservative values,
mm-hmm.
your lunch conversations are going to be very frustrating.
You know, I think back.
And nobody's wrong and nobody's right, right?
It's just different.
You have to know you and the company. And this is, again, we got a couple of minutes.
Shit.
Go look at Christina Maslach's work-loaf balance stuff. And it's another level of, it's a much more complicated psychometric survey,
mm-hmm.
but it's one where it allows you to understand who you are, what frustrates and burns you out, and what a company's values are. And the only question really is, they're not wrong, you're not wrong, the two together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been in relationships like that. Exactly. So John, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for being such a... you know, from the day I met you, you know, the people I love are the people that we get way beyond just the sort of the Kubernetes and the containers and there's just the people I want to be around is people think much deeper about humans and
yeah.
life. And you're just one of those guys.
Thank you. I love technology, but I love people more.
Totally.
And I think that without the really big hopes and dreams of making sure people are safe and happy, then we're never going to have great working environments.
And it's clear that you think deeply about that. And you're afraid of the Yankees fan.
Yes. One of the things John and I kind of picked up on when we first kind of met is that I'm a Yankees fan, he's a Yankees fan. For those of you who don't like baseball, too freaking bad. We both had a hard end of our season. It ended with one swing of a bat by a short man. That short man hopefully will lose tonight. I'm guessing they're probably going to win thanks to me saying this now.
But you go,
sorry, Astros fans. Anyhow, John, people can get in touch with you online. I know that's Bacchagaloop.
Bacchagaloop on Twitter, bacchagaloop@gmail.com. I will have sort of a Red Hat presence sooner or later, but I'm always available at Bacchagaloop. So.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, John. I'm going to wrap things up. We'll catch you soon at the next... I don't know. I'm going to edit out this part. It sounds really dumb. We'll see you at the wrap-up. Thank you.
I don't know. I guess that little part at the end was too much fun and silly to edit out, so I left it in. That was really one of my favorite conversations ever. I can't help but say that John is a... it's hard to come up with real great descriptions of what John is, but John is a heart and soul of a lot of what we do in DevOps. Tremendous amount of heart in that man, and I really do appreciate all the time that he's given me over the years. So thanks, John. You can reach him on Twitter at Bachagaloof. I'll make sure, for those of you who may not be sure how that's spelled, I'll put it in the show notes. So I'll be at Microsoft Ignite next week. I have a podcast area set up, so I'm going to be doing some great podcasts. I've got some stuff lined up with some coworkers, some non-coworkers, just people attending. I think you're really going to enjoy what I've got coming up in the next few weeks. I got two other interviews that I am waiting to release. One with Brian Finster of Walmart, who was also at the Does in Las Vegas, as well as Damon Edwards of Rundeck. So, I mean, we're talking about really great DevOps leaders. And I just want to, once again, give a little thank you to Gene Kim and Jeremy Douglas, Ann Perry, all the people at IT Revolution and the DevOps Enterprise Summit. They were super awesome to me. They gave me so much access to really smart people. They gave me a suite to record in. I can't thank them enough. And I do think that I'm going to be going to the one in London and probably come back to Vegas in 2021. So that's it for this week's episode of the On-Call Nightmares podcast. If you'd like to be on, send me an email, oncallnightmares@gmail.com. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.